Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. When photographer Jimmy Nelson travels to the most remote communities on this planet, meeting the people there and taking their portraits, he knows he's courting controversy. Because historically, photos of indigenous peoples have been instruments of exoticism, tainted by the colonialism and cruelty that often comes with contact. But Jimmy Nelson is aiming for something entirely different. He seeks not to exoticize, but instead to exalt, to celebrate the pride indigenous people have about their own cultures. And Nelson says, hopefully foster a sense of empathy in those who view these artful images. This hour on Point, photographer Jimmy Nelson and his homage to humanity. And you can join us. What do you make of Western photographers and their portraits of indigenous people? We've seen them in everything from old colonial museum portraits to National Geographic covers that have powerfully connected us to people in every corner of the world. Where do we draw the line between fostering empathy and exoticism? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, Jimmy Nelson joins us today from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. He has traveled the world for National Geographic, among other magazines, and his new book of portraits is called Homage to Humanity. Now, if you go to our website, onpointradio.org, you will find some photos, videos, and information on how to download an interactive app that comes with the book. That's actually also an interesting aspect of this new work that we'll talk about. And we have a link to Homage to Humanity, the project gallery of photos that those are publicly available. So again, that's onpointradio.org. But first, let me welcome Jimmy Nelson to the program. Jimmy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi.
Nice to speak to you.
It's great to have you. And I wanted to go through that long introduction because I did want to point listeners to our website for those who haven't seen your work to take a look at it, because it truly is, I mean, captivating is how I felt, captivated is how I felt as I looked through the book here. And I just want to...
Thank you. It's a...
No, go ahead.
Carry on, Karen.
Go ahead. I think there's a tiny...
Thank you. I mean, I think your introduction is very succinct and it's very true and it's sort of almost bipolar. This whole discussion, this whole illustration, this whole... You could even call it artistry. It's not necessarily my artistry, but the artistry of these cultures themselves presents such a conundrum. How do we look at them and how do they actually look at themselves? So I think it's actually a fascinating discussion as presently at this day and age.
Yeah. So let's talk more about that. And I actually want to use a couple of pictures specifically in the book to sort of give us a better sense as to what you're, you know, what you're trying to do here and what we as the viewers see. Mm-hmm. For example, you have this stunning series of photographs of the Kazakh people in Mongolia. They're eagle. Right. They use eagles. They're master eagle hunters, right? And there's this series of photos. You see the sort of the Mongolian steppe behind these.
This is a very significant, and actually, I'm very happy you begin with this chapter, because this was actually this group of people, this culture, were also part of the first book I published 4 years ago before they passed away. It was actually the very first group of people I visited for the project in 2011. First of all, the landscape that they live in is mind-blowingly beautiful. It's the Altai Mountains and the far northwest of Mongolia. It's the layers of color and depth are captivating. And then living within it are this community of people who are extremely attached to an ancient tradition, a tradition they abandoned in many ways when they were in Kazakhstan, which was part of Russia. And then a small group of them migrated a few centuries ago into northwestern Mongolia. And when I first visited them about 8 years ago, there were only about 40 eagle hunters still left.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so
in Homage to Humanity, Yeah, carry on.
Sorry, I apologize if it sounds like I'm interrupting you. It seems like there's a tiny delay on the line here. Pictures, I mean, you have these close-up portraits, for example, of some of the eagle hunters with the themselves and their magnificence, and then the birds as well perched on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I wanted to ask you about these series of pictures is because I think I've heard you say in previous interviews that this experience says something about you and how you connected to the people you were photographing in Mongolia. Can you tell us about what happened to you here?
Yeah, well, on this particular moment when I was taking the pictures, or in the past, what the process that brought me to where I am now?
Well, if I remember correctly, is it not with the eagle hunters here that you experienced a particular moment of your personal vulnerability and how that helped you connect with them?
I vaguely remember. Yeah, I think they are, like most of the traditions and the cultures and tribes that I photograph, they're very deeply connected to rituals. And it's those rituals I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to apply, I'm trying to portray and visualize and share, and also sort of reflect not only for us, but also on themselves, how important and how valuable they are. And I think what pushed me on this journey, and it's a lifelong journey, I'm now 50 years old, and I've been traveling since the day I was born to these extraordinary places, was in my teenage years, I had this sort of bipolar existence. I lived in these remote cultures with these communities with my parents, whilst at the same time I was being educated in a very traditional English boarding school run by Catholic Jesuit priests. And by default, I was sort of unconsciously encouraged to disconnect from my emotions, disconnect from my sensitivity as a human being through that education. And I think I've spent the whole of my adult life trying inadvertently to reconnect with this. And I do that subconsciously by visiting these traditional cultures. And when I first went to the Kazakh, I was overly enthusiastic, as I often am, standing on top of a mountain very early one morning. And I think it was about minus 30 degrees centigrade. And I'd spent the better part of 3 weeks living with this community. And we'd, as best as one can be without using a language, become friends. I'd managed to communicate the reason for my visit, this idea of wanting to pay homage, as you so kindly suggested in your introduction. And I got carried away with the beauty of these people, their tradition, carrying these magnificent eagles. But on this February cold morning at minus 30 degrees on top of a mountain, including wind chill factor, and I took off my gloves and to change the lens of the camera. Now, the cameras I use are also a reflection of the past. They're traditional plate cameras, 4x5 analog film. And I needed my bare fingers to change the lens. And I subsequently got stuck to the plate of the camera and stood there like a rather semi-handicapped Mr. Bean-esque character, incapable or incapacitated by my enthusiasm. And much to their sort of surprise and awe and in many ways disappointment. And then they were sort of encouraging to remove my fingers from the camera, which I did. I subsequently left most of the skin of the tips of the fingers behind because it had frozen to the camera and had a sort of a physical breakdown. My fingers were bleeding. I couldn't function anymore. And it was perhaps not the pain which hurt. It was more the fact that this picture, this glorious, magnificent landscape with these people was unfolding in front of me in sunrise, which was the reason we climbed up there at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I couldn't actually capture it the way I saw it. And I was approached by two women who came up to me from behind and saw my sort of state of despair, grabbed me, held me very close and put my hands on their chest and essentially sort of bear hugged me with these sort of very big foxskin jackets and slowly brought me back to warmth, slowly brought me back to being able to use my fingers. And I subsequently turned around 5 minutes later and was able to make that one picture. And I think the thrill of the process is by putting oneself in such a vulnerable situation, in extraordinary physical and in some case mentally challenging circumstances, you go over the edge. You end up showing a part of your personality that's extremely vulnerable and reflects on how you feel and what you want to see and what you want to share. And in that process, these what are all in essence strangers showed a form of humanity and empathy towards me that was perhaps the greater goal of what I'm trying to achieve.
Yeah. So then How is it that you try to communicate that humanity that you personally experienced with them? How do you communicate that in your photographs?
Well, I think it came when I was a late teenager. I ran away. I'd spent 10 years living in this institution. I was not amused by what had happened to me. As a variety of a lot of issues to do with stress, my hair fell out when I was 16. So I decided one morning I woke up and looked in the mirror that I'd become extremely ugly. And I ran away inspired by Tintin. And Tintin in Tibet. And I thought, well, there's the only place on the planet that I can actually go and find other human beings that may look like me and perhaps not judge me are the monks in Tibet, although I'd never been there before. So in 1985, I ended up by default walking the length, traveling the length of Tibet. And in that period of 2 years between the ages of 17 and 19, I was shown more kindness. I was shown more warmth. I was shown more, in the broader sense of the word, love than I'd ever actually experienced either in my from my family or from the school that I was being taught in. And that became, in many ways, a sort of an addictive process. And each person who gave me that kindness and lack of judgment and warmth and empathy, I took a picture of. And I think, in many ways, 33 years later, that's what I'm still doing today. And I want to share that feeling. I want to show that respect and that connection that I make in my rather eccentric way with the world.
Eccentric way, but it's producing some incredible visual results here. We've got about 30 seconds
Thank
before
you.
I have to take a break here. Can you just give us a brief list of all the, of some of the places you've been?
Oh, it's a list. It's sort of unending. The whole of Southeast Asia, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu is extremely exciting, and a group of an archipelago of 83 islands in the Pacific, the Marquesa Islands there in the far northern Pacific, Mongolia, northern Siberia on a number of occasions, you name it, I think I've probably been there.
Well, we are talking with Jimmy Nelson. He is a photographer who's worked for National Geographic, amongst many others. He has a new book of portraits of indigenous people from around the world. The book is called Homage to Humanity. And by the way, go to onpointradio.org if you have a second and check out, we have a lot of the images that Jimmy's taken available at our website. Take a look at them and tell us what you see when you look at these images that Jimmy Nelson has taken around the world. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You're listening to what it sounded like last year in a village in the Papua New Guinean Highlands when the people there, the Huli, threw a party as Jimmy Nelson and his crew prepared to leave the village. Jimmy Nelson is a photographer. He's traveled the world taking portraits, striking portraits of indigenous peoples around the world. And many of those works are in a new book called Homage to Humanity. And if you go to our website, onpointradio.org, you can find photos, videos, and information about an interactive element that this new book has as well. But definitely take a look at the pictures and let us know what you see when you look at these images of indigenous people from around the world. Jimmy Nelson, I wanted to ask you a couple of more questions about your particular process and how you win the trust of the people you're taking pictures of. Because, of course, the first most, I would say, understandable and immediate reaction of anyone when a photographer comes around, especially a Western photographer, is, what are you doing here and why should I let you take my picture? So how do you overcome that?
It's a very important and very good question. It's a layered process. First of all, I think you have to be extremely humble and extremely vulnerable and realize that the majority of these people perhaps have never seen a camera before. They have no idea what it means. They often, in many cases where I go to, they've never seen essentially a foreigner, let's call it a white man for the sake of argument. And if they have, or even if they haven't, they've often heard, we're a threat. So as opposed to arriving in a helicopter or with an entourage or with big cars or with long lenses on digital cameras, you have to invert that process. You have to arrive as nobody, metaphorically. You have to arrive and succumb. You have to give in and put yourself at their feet. And I think I often use the analogy, if you sort of bring a new dog home, and the new dog immediately wants to give you the authority. It says, you're the boss. So it sort of puts itself at your feet. That's what I do. I don't go in with any plan, with any authority, with any anticipation, with zero expectation other than to say, I'm another human being. I'm putting myself at your feet. And only when you're comfortable and when you're ready can we start a form of interaction. Secondly, and probably one of the most important aspects, is try never to take translators. Because if you take a translator, you ease and you delegate the process of communication. If I'm trying to communicate with you, but we don't speak the same language, and I find somebody who can communicate to you, I never actually talk to you. I end up talking to the translator. By far the best way to explain who you are, which is the most important element, and then why you're there, is to do it yourself. If you don't have any language, you have to go to extreme measures to find a way to physically explain the reason for your visit.
But may I just jump in here for a second? Because this is such an interesting aspect of your approach. Because I get what you're saying about, there's almost sort of, you have to reach a primal level of communication, for example, a totally authentic level of communication with no translator.
You have to go very deep inside. You have to be very... brave is a big word, but when I started doing this after my teenage years, I felt I had nothing to lose anymore. I had no dignity. I had no respect. I essentially loathed what I stood for and what I felt. So I sort of jumped. I jumped into the world and I jumped into the lap of the other. And I wanted to sort of say to them, see me for who I am. See me for not the way I look, not the way I smell, not the color of my skin, not what I believe in or not what I have to say. See me for my heart and see me for my soul. And the only way to do that is by breaking down the barriers. After my childhood, I had no barriers anymore. I had nothing to lose. So it wasn't about being brave. I just jumped.
Yeah.
And over the years, that process has evolved where you become... it's described as fearless, but there's nothing to be afraid of. If you visit these people and you put yourself in a vulnerable situation, and if you trust that you can eventually show the essence of who you are as a human being, you will make contact and you will get their trust and form an empathy to eventually... it's a very long process and it takes weeks and in some case months. Eventually, record that meeting and record that meeting in a subjective, romantic, aspirational, dignified way. And that's how I see and feel these people that I present in the book and on the app once I've been through that process.
Okay, so subjective, romantic, aspirational. Now, taken in a different context, though, there are you've had critics for your past work who say that amounts to exoticism because you may be connecting with them in a sort of primal way. But how much of them do you really get to know? How much of they themselves are we seeing in terms of the image that they want to present to the world?
That's another extremely important question, and thank you for asking it. First of all, the discussion is, what is exotic? it remains and always will remain very subjective. I often reply by saying, well, how do we see ourselves when we present ourselves in a publication, in a book? Often we present ourselves in our most dignified, inspirational, aspirational way. You could be regarded as being exotic. What is the reality of who we are when we wake up on a Saturday morning, having had a heavy night of alcohol the night before with harsh light on us as we're being photographed? It's often very dignified, than very different than the exotic way we present ourselves. And much the same. And then the other part of the question is being, how do they see themselves? Very important. And when I went through the first process and before they passed away, I promised and I gave them, and I've also given myself the word, I have to return with the pictures I took. So if you use the terminology, taking a picture, I did take a picture. I didn't take their soul. I didn't take anything literally from them, but I took their picture. And now I'm slowly returning, and that's very much what part of Homage to Humanity is, returning back with the pictures I took to give back and then share, this time with a translator, this is what I took of you. What do you think? This is what was in that box. What do you think of the book? How have I seen you? And then ultimately, the further stage of the project is, how do you eventually see yourself and what do you want to share within that?
Mm. This is so interesting because I wonder, would you call what you do art, journalism? I mean, what is it? Because what we don't see in these images is, I mean, we see spectacular human beings for sure. But what we,
which they are,
we don't, what we don't see is evidence of how much their current cultures in the 21st century are synergizing with modernity. We don't see perhaps some of the challenges they're facing at that sharp edge of modernity. I was thinking about Papua New Guinea. I mean,
it is. I mean, it's a very important. It's a good. What is it?
Yeah.
Is it journalism? I don't think it is journalism. No, I think perhaps when I was younger, I naively started out as a journalist, and I think now, although I have difficulty with that terminology because I don't see myself as one, but the work is art. It's my interpretation of what I see and I feel when I go to these communities and that I want to share. And I think all art, all good art, it doesn't matter what form it takes, is a catalyst of discussion. And by default, the work that I do, the artistry are the people and the cultures themselves. I'm the gatherer of that beauty, and that power has caused a fairly interesting, using a metaphor, colorful discussion. You know, what is true, what is exotic, what is real, and how important is it or is it not?
Well, I mean, because I'm thinking about the criticism that you face from your previous book, Before They Pass Away. I mean, many people just outright objected to the title of that book, saying that you were photographing cultures that were not passing away at all.
They were. I think the title was, it was, I still stand behind it. And by default, I think that's what caused a greater interest in this subject matter, because it was controversial. It was naively controversial. The English translation is before somebody dies, before they pass away. Nobody's actually dying, but a culture is changing rapidly. So it was a naive title, a title that caused quite an interesting discussion. And if anybody who's learnt more from the discussion, it has been me, and that it was actually the catalyst for producing Homage to Humanity.
Mm. Well, actually, let's turn to some callers here. We're speaking with Jimmy Nelson. He's joining us today from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. He's a photographer who's worked for many magazines, National Geographic, amongst others. And his new book is called Homage to Humanity. It is a spectacular collection of portraits of indigenous people he's taken from around the world. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, to take a look at several of these portraits and let us know what you think about Western photographers and what we gain or perhaps what we risk when we take when we travel the world to take pictures of indigenous people. And what do they gain from it, if anything? Let's go to Patricia, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Patricia, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi,
Patricia.
Listen, I'm calling because I'm also a photographer, and I've have some of the same emotions and motivation that Jimmy does. Jimmy, I think your work is beautiful. I think
thank you very much.
The things that I, you're welcome. I think one of the things that's so interesting is your approach as someone who is there to learn, that is someone there to observe and share and acknowledge the truth of the people that are you're capturing, and then bringing it to the rest of the world so that we can appreciate culture that has been around for such a long time and that has informed us. And so I just want to let you know, my son is also a photographer. I'm going to buy the book for his Christmas. I hope he's not listening, but it's a wonderful, wonderful
I won't tell him.
project that yeah. you're doing, well, and I appreciate
Thank you very much for the compliment, but it's also nice to say you're buying it for your son, who's a photographer, and also returning a little bit to the previous question, is this the fact that the first book caused so much discussion. I was desperate to share and show my emotion, show my soul and the process that I go into it. I don't think anybody's impressed anymore by photographers or the process of taking a picture, because anybody can do that now. It's the emotion that's invested into the process and the morality and the motivation behind it, as you touched on. Homage to Humanity has been produced with an app. And if anything, I'm proudest of this, because I dared and I trusted two very young guys here in Amsterdam who 3 years ago came to me and said, Jimmy, you have to make a new book. You have to show the world what you invest when you're doing it emotionally, so that they better understand. And there's less controversy, but there's more empathy and participation in this discussion. Mm-hmm. So the app is linked to it. It's free. So it's called the Jimmy Nelson app. Anybody in the world can have it, so you don't need to buy the book. If you see the pictures on a computer screen or on a wall or in a museum, and the app with your smartphone activates the pictures. Now, in the book, there are 600 images. Each one of them has a digital layer behind it, or films. And those films are very, to use a metaphor again, naked. You see me working. You see me communicating. You see me crying. You see me laughing. And you see all the aspects of the reality of what it is there. And you are right to say, my perspective is very subjective. Around me, there are often standing people with mobile phones and T-shirts who are very much part of how the culture is evolving. So I share that with you. I just show you my perspective on what I'm trying to show.
Yeah. So can I ask you, this is the fundamental question surrounding anyone who endeavors to do the work, the kind of work that you do, whether it be for art or for journalism. Because at the heart of the photographer's dilemma, from, you know, the time back when daguerreotypes were first invented all the way to now.
I actually think some of the very first pictures of the daguerreotype were made of traditional cultures.
Well, so this is the question, right? That ultimately the image that we, the viewer, see and engage with is one that passes through the eye of the photographer, him or herself. And as you just said, for many of your images, there are certain realities of the indigenous people in their culture which you are actively editing out. And so I'm just wondering, coming back to this question, how much of these people are we seeing as they would want to see themselves, or is it as Jimmy Nelson wants us to see them, even if it's for the best of intentions?
Well, I think it is for the best of intentions, but it's layered in three ways. There are three layers. First of all, it's my perspective, the picture I make. It remains subjective. Every photograph that was ever made since the very first daguerreotype is the photographer's subjective perspective of what they're trying to show. It's his own or her own truth. Secondly, now with this app, this is the first ever book of this theme. Well, it's the first ever book of its kind ever to be with this digital application. Yeah. So I show you everything.
Yeah.
Any viewer anywhere in the world can make up their own interpretation, come up with their own conclusions, because I nakedly show you where I am and what I'm doing behind the image digitally. And then thirdly, we've produced a foundation. And it was always, I felt very morally obliged. Part of this conversation is, what are you doing to them? What do they want? How do you influence it? How do you change it? And ultimately, I wanted to give something back. So the first process was to take the pictures back. That's a beginning. But I don't actually believe it's enough. So now what I'm doing with trying to do, and this is a very ambitious project, and I have many years to try and achieve it, is as best as possible to create teams of inspired young, but that's young in mind and in spirit, it doesn't matter with what age, of young photographers and filmmakers to tread in my footsteps, go to these communities and leave and teach them to use their own cameras.
Yeah.
And then eventually to have this long-term participation in this project of this global gathering of this traditional knowledge and culture and share it with the world from their perspective, share how they see themselves, share how they would like to present themselves to the world. But then also the question of who they are, what they feel, how they want to evolve, what they want to take with them, what they want to leave behind. And in that way. So I'm very busy with being aware of this process. It's extremely important that they have a voice, they have an opinion, and they can show and share that with the world. But it will take time.
And how long will it take? Because I am very excited to see what those photographs might reveal to us.
We've already started, but I'm sure it'll take far beyond my own lifetime.
All right. Well, we have to take a very quick break here. We're talking with Jimmy Nelson. He's a photographer who's traveled the world taking portraits, really stunning portraits of Indigenous people around the world. Many of them are collected in his new book, Homage to Humanity. If you go to our website, onpointradio.org, we've got some of the images we've been talking about here today. Take a look at them and let us know what you think. What do you see? Does it generate a sense of empathy for people living in Papua New Guinea when you look at Jimmy Nelson's photographs? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Jimmy Nelson. He is a photographer who's traveled the world taking portraits of Indigenous people from around the world. Many of them, hundreds of them, are collected in the new book, Homage to Humanity. And Jimmy, we've got a lot of comments coming in here. Olga13 on Twitter says, "The beauty of humanity is often hidden beneath its exterior. Jimmy Nelson's lens seems to transcend this." Thinking 15 says, "I love this project. Beautiful photographs of so many beautiful people." And someone else calling themselves Guess or Jess, G-E-S-S, says, "Why are empathy and exoticism the range? I doubt that Indigenous people see themselves as either or anywhere in between. How about the photographers serve as a clean window without filter or judgment?" Jimmy Nelson, do you think that's even possible?
It's not possible, no, because as a human being, we're all fallible. We're all connected to our emotions, or we're all trying to become connected to our emotions. So that's not possible. Only a robot could perhaps achieve that. But then you wouldn't have art, you wouldn't have feeling, you wouldn't have emotion. And I think, you know, so to bring it back to the human aspect, to the emotional aspect, I feel very strongly a sort of a parallel layer to the project is this idea of fear. By becoming, by default, fearless, I end up seeing the world or cultures of the world in a very, very different way, in an inspiring way. I think the way the world is becoming, the developed part of the world, and especially I sort of hear on in with the adverts a few minutes ago referring to your midterms and your politics in the States at the moment, a lot of it's based on fear, this whole idea of the other, the different color, the different culture, and this regressing back to sort of some sort of behind a wall. I think personally, that's a disaster for human beings on this planet because you cannot stop globalization. You cannot stop migration. You cannot stop homogenization. And the sooner we look at one another in this romantic, dignified, respectful way and embrace one another's differences. Mm. Only then can we progress as human beings in a respectful, healthy way.
Well, let's,
so that's very much a layer behind it.
Well, let's go to Nick, who's calling from Eastville, Virginia. Nick, you're on the air with Jimmy Nelson.
Oh, hi, Mr. Nelson. Howdy. It sounds like you're really making yourself vulnerable as far as this whole project, just by everything I can hear what you're saying. I just had a comment and a couple of questions. I'm not really thrilled with people taking my picture, and I don't really know how I'd feel if I was an indigenous person. That's, you know, like someone, you know, everyone says, and you came up. I wouldn't. Do they? So that kind of frames my question: is do they know exactly what you're doing? What the product is going to be before you take the picture? And my other question is, you say that you go back to them later with the book and see how they like it. Mm-hmm. What if they don't like it? At that point, would it have been better maybe just have a galley or something like that so you can scrap the project if they don't like it? Or, you know, that how would that work?
Nick, thank you for your call. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Yeah, good questions, Nick. Very, very good questions. So thank you for your... What do they feel when I returned? All of them till date, and I may be proved wrong in the future, were, and this sounds a bit melodramatic, honored. They said, you know, you weren't the first person to come to us. You weren't the first person to discover us. We've all been discovered. You weren't the first person to take our picture or point this box at us. But you're the very first person to ever bother, because we went back with translators, to come back to us. So that fact in itself shows us respect and dignity. So for that fact, you can become metaphorically one of us. As to what we now think about the pictures, you're right. We have an opinion. Some of it is positive, some of it is negative, and we would like to share that. So that's included in Homage to Humanity, their opinion, whether I'm right or wrong. And then thirdly, that process of do they want it in the first place? I don't think... I'm now looking at myself here, and I've got a sort of a window in front of me. I don't like the face that I have. I haven't liked it since I was a teenager. I have no hair at all. I feel very confronted every time I look in the mirror at the face that I see, because it's not the person I feel that I am. I can look somewhat aggressive. As a child, I was a punk skinhead. But that's the complete inverse of who I was as a child. I'm a very empathetic, extremely sensitive, creative, almost androgynous character. But my skin, my appearance, was of one of an aggressor. I've essentially done everything to date and still do to try and invert that. If somebody, and I remember as a child, I wanted to experiment with this process. How can people judge me by my appearance when they don't know who I am? So I used to dress up when I was in my late teens after my journey across Tibet and sit on a wall in central London as a punk, and I would attach earrings and smoke and have these big Mohicans and wear this sort of... And I was often experimenting with almost street theatre to how people would react to me. Now, many people from afar would point a camera at me, tourists or locals, and take pictures. They would shoot me and laugh without looking at me in the eyes and walk away. I felt very angry.
Yeah.
Well, there were a few people who made the effort and came up and sat next to me fearlessly. They asked my name. They asked where I was from. They offered me a cigarette. We started a conversation. And then halfway through the conversation, they gave me a compliment. They said, "You look amazing." I don't know how you look, but you look amazing. Can we take your picture? For those people, I gave them every hour of the day.
Yeah. Jimmy, it's about
a respect and a contact.
So can I just, this leads me to a question that I've actually wanted to ask you for some time, because...
Okay, here goes.
the question ultimately is a simple one, but I want to give a little background first. Because you've talked about some of the formative experiences in your life, but I mean, in a little bit of greater detail, from the time you were a very young child until you were seven, your father was a geologist, right? Mm-hmm. So you were able as a child to travel around the world and actually live in many of indigenous communities at that time as a child. Is that right?
I think, yeah, he was an extremely intelligent professor, but very autistic, very incapable of communicating with human beings and me. He had a good heart.
Yeah.
He spoke by default, and it's somewhat amusing, 15 languages, although he couldn't actually talk to people. And he was a geologist. He went exploring. He wanted to understand the depths of the world, the origins of the world. That was by understanding stones. And he took me with him to the world's most remotest corners and communities.
And then when you were 7 or 8, though, you were sent to a boarding school, as you said, in the UK, a Jesuit boarding school where you had some very difficult experiences. I've read you've said you were abused at that boarding school.
Yeah, I was sort of taken out of that. And I romantically described those first 7 years of my life as formative, but essentially a little bit like Mowgli. I ran free, naked through the nature with local communities. I didn't know any different. I was 7 years old. I was told I had to learn to read and write, and that wasn't achievable in the bush, so to speak. So I was put in this institution with 400 priests, Jesuit Catholic priests, and 1,000 boys. In a building, if you imagine like Hogwarts from Harry Potter, but with no magic whatsoever, and 30 kilometers away from the nearest village. And it was an isolated compound. And behind those walls, some very profound things happened to me. And I think as a child, I wasn't aware of it. But as I reflect back now, it formed me. Mm. Firstly, I was told when I arrived, I was poor because I had pictures of me in my natural setting. I wasn't wearing clothes. Secondly, I hung around with colored children, Negroes or Melanesian children in Papua New Guinea. I should not fraternize or associate.
That's what they were telling to you at the time, yeah.
But I, as a 7-year-old, said I didn't see the color. I only saw them as my friends. So I was immediately ostracized. Then I was told, you're stupid because you can't read and write. And I said, yeah, but I haven't needed that up until now. I survive in a different way. And then the two most profound aspects was sexual abuse. That, I think, happened to many children in the 70s in Catholic institutions. So I'm not unique in that way. But what it did do would it disconnects you from yourself. You can survive. I mean, children around the planet, many millions of children survive far worse. But the only way to do that is you have to emotionally disconnect with all forms of feeling. So you evolve as a child, and I disconnected. So no feelings, no emotions whatsoever. The abuse stopped. Being English, people don't like to talk about things that are painful. You know, we sort of close the curtains and look at the weather and have another cucumber sandwich. And then because of my sensitivity as a human being and my creativity and my androgyninity, I was struggling because I was trying to reconnect with myself physically. And the worst thing happened. I lost my hair within 12 hours due to being given the wrong antibiotics by a priest because I was suffering from a malaria having just come back from the tropics.
Well, and so
I woke up and I looked in the mirror, and as I look now, and I was presented with somebody else's face. So in that moment, you're completely, utterly confronted with being, seeing the other by being the other, and then subsequently by being treated as the other and ostracized for being different, although you did not feel it.
Well, so here's why, I'm very grateful that you gave us more detail about
your
life.
It's very much part of the process.
because here's why I'm asking. Because everything that you just told us, that gives us a visual image of the life and the person that you, Jimmy Nelson, are, sort of the culture of your life and your experiences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel like I understand you in a somewhat profound way now. And so how would you, what picture would you take of yourself that would tell that story? And I ask because, do your pictures of Indigenous people help tell their stories to the degree of detail that we just got to know you?
Okay, well, now you're going to make me cry because you're asking probably the most important question. Nobody's ever asked this to me before. When you look through the book, I want you to see me. The other day, a lady bought the book and she came to my studio and she said, you know, Jimmy, I don't like books. I think you exoticize these people. Tribes are distant and far away. I don't like photography. It's far too expensive. But I'm obsessed by this book because every time I turn a page, these people are looking at me and I feel they're connecting with me. Explain why. And I said, but that's because perhaps you're looking at me. because of the effort, the time, the emotion, the investment that I put in to connect with these people, to see them, to ultimately, and it's not about photography, but record them and share them with you, is who I am and it's how I feel and the beauty of what I see. And I have tears in my eyes as I share it. And what I feel is that's how I want to see myself. And that's it. So that's why perhaps it becomes art. It transcends photography or journalism. It's this very, very personal process of how I feel about the world and how I wished I was seen myself. And I think what happened, and the reason I cry now, is because a few weeks ago, a couple of Dutch adults came to my studio to buy a picture, and the sales of which facilitate the ongoing growth of the project. And they bought a 7-year-old child, so a child of the same age I was when I was taken out of the confines of my security. And they brought him into the studio, and he was running around because he probably had too much sugar, and he was annoyed, and the parents were annoyed with him, and they shouted at him and said, "Shut up." And they looked at me and said, "Give him something to do." So I gave him a pair of Oculus Rift three-dimensional glasses, mm-hmm. within which the content was of, by default, Papua New Guinea. And he started going around in circles and around and around. He eventually screamed at the top of his voice, "Wow, this is amazing. You cannot believe what..." He was seven. "There are lots of naked people with yellow faces dancing around me." Now, the first reaction of his parents was, "Take those glasses off his head." And you know what he did? He put his hands over. He said, "Leave me alone. Huh. Leave me alone. I find this fascinating. These people are amazing. They see me. They're touching me. They're dancing around me. Leave me here. I want to know more. I'm fine." And I found that extremely profound, because here was a 7-year-old who had no judgment. He had no fear. Every adult you put these glasses on is immediately afraid. This 7-year-old was curious. He was fascinated. And if I've managed to instigate a curiosity in a child of 7 that will form his life to look at the other in the way I perhaps felt as a child, then there must be something good about what I'm trying to do, even if it's for that one child.
Well, Jimmy, we just have a couple of minutes left to go. And thank you, by the way, so much for engaging
with
me.
Sorry, I sound like I'm preaching
question.
Now, but it was your question.
Well, I, you know, speaking with people who have that degree of commitment and passion to what they do is one of the great fortunes of this job. So please don't ever apologize for.
Well, it was a very good question. You touched me. And when you said, "How do you want to be seen?" I want to be seen as I portray these people in this book. That is my biggest wish. It will never happen, but that's the motivation behind it.
Well, I just have enough time probably for one call. Brian is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Brian, we've just got about a minute and a half left here to go. So hopefully you can share your thought really quickly with Jimmy Nielsen.
Hi, I'll be very quick here. First of all, you inspired me since I was a child and were one of my windows in surviving abuse. And I'm now a founder who works with the Maasai. And how you talk about approaching people in their own space and with authenticity is the basis of what has created the relationships that we've been able to develop into enormous projects with them. And so I want to say thank you, first of all. And second of all, I'll leave this and take it off the air, hopefully, but how can people help to make sure this project of people telling their stories grows?
Yeah. Well, Brian, thank you for your call. And Jimmy, we just got about a minute to go.
Yeah, I wipe away my tears quickly, Brian. Thank you for that word of enthusiasm and confidence. And that one compliment gives me energy to carry on doing. How can people help? Well, I think in the simplest way, and with the listeners there in the States, is look at your neighbor in a different way. And I don't mean to sound in any way religious. It's just when you see somebody, and they may look different, they may look you may be afraid of them, but just take that 1 second to look beyond and look at the human being behind them. I think that's the first stage and the simplest stage that we can all do. There further, if you want to go off into the world, come to my website and go to the foundation, and we're always looking for curious, adventurous souls.
Well, Jimmy Nielsen is a photographer who has traveled the world, really, so many places in the world, taking photographs and portraits of Indigenous people. His work is assembled into his latest book called Homage to Humanity. If you go to onpointradio.org, you can see several images there and learn about, as Jimmy said, the other layers that are in this book, the videos and the interviews and the sounds that you hear that he's collected from around the world. Jimmy Nelson, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
The feeling is totally mutual. Thank you very much for the beautiful questions and having me on the show.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.